like to ask you a very important question.
I wonder where that rooster was. Hello, friends. Greg Kokel, Stand to Reason, and thank you for joining me today. I am here live and lively, and thanks again to Brett Kunkel for filling in for me last week. I actually caught part of the show as I had a break from my speaking at University of Missouri, and I streamed the show and had a little fun there, eavesdropping in on Brett. Welcome to Stand to Reason. This is the marketplace of ideas where issues of philosophy and religion are discussed right here in the public forum of talk radio. And we have our whole second hour devoted to conversation about a new book written by Hugh Hewitt. He will be in the studio with me along with Dr. Craig Hazen from Biola and Dr. John Mark Reynolds, also of Biola. We'll be talking about the book A Mormon in the White House. By Hugh, which is climbing the charts and an issue that we need to be speaking about because we're in the race. And though I am not here to promote a candidate, I certainly care about you guys. Excuse me. I certainly care about you guys and how you make your decision that you use your minds well in this process. So we'll be devoting the entire second hour to that discussion, which means the whole first hour is for you. 1-800-227-5278. Is my number, and you can dial up and get in the queue, talk to the enforcer, and she'll put you through to me if you treat her nice. And then we'll talk about anything that's on your mind in the area of ethics, values, and religion. If you're local here, in the 714 area code, the 754-4150 is the number. And so you're welcome to give me a call, and I'd love to chat with you about whatever's on your mind in those broad areas. And before I do, though, I want to let you know about something. Since this is kind of an in-home crowd, I mean, we've been working together, you and I, for many of you, almost 18 years now, and you are very faithful to Stand to Reason. Let me let you know something that we're facing, something actually that comes up very, very rarely, but it's a reality right now. For some reason, and I don't understand it, we're not the only one that is experiencing this, but we're really getting hit hard financially here in the first couple of months, 4 months now, of 2007, now into our fifth month. We are actually right now, as we follow our budget, we are $35,000 below our 2006 budget. Now, you know, if you run organizations, you're looking to grow. So the 2007 budget is usually higher than the 2006, and that's our case. Not irresponsibly so, but it is. That means we're not just falling short of our current budget, which has current expenditures attached to it. For some reasons, we're not even keeping up with last year's giving. Now, other organizations have said that they're feeling it too, and we don't know what the deal is. But even when other organizations hit the skids a little bit during the year, we don't seem to, and so we're not used to this. So I'm just passing it on. We have a financial need right now, and for the last 4 months, we've been hit pretty hard. And those of you who are part of our family and who have been giving in the past, thank you for that help. And you may want to consider putting a little extra in the mail for us this month. If you've never given before, you may want to think about maybe this being your first time. This would be a good time to do it, by the way, because we want to break this trend, especially as we're moving into the summer, which is a tough time for organizations generally. People go on vacations and just forget to send their checks in. So we don't want to have to face that in the next couple of months. So just letting you know as a friend and as somebody who cares about STR, this is a shortfall that we're facing, and we're getting a little concerned about it. So we're praying hard, but we want to let you know about our needs as well. Let's see. 1-800-227-5278 in the 714 area code 754-4150. I was at the University of Missouri last week, and I talked on Friday night and on Saturday night. Bad arguments against religion was the topic on Friday night. And Saturday night, I talked about why Jesus is the only way of salvation. Now, this is such an important talk, especially on campus, because it is a very controversial talk. The notion, I should say, that Jesus is the only way is deeply offensive to people, and especially in a pluralistic society. And so it's very, very, very important, it seems to me, for us to take this central claim of Christianity and try to have it make sense to people. And I think Christians have been they have not been good at making sense of this claim in the past, and partly because I don't know that they entirely understand the guts of the theology that's behind it. And we've talked about this before, but an issue came up, or I should say an illustration, that I just want to pass on to you. And after I was done speaking on Saturday night, a woman got up, a young lady, and she asked me, what about Unitarians? Now, Unitarians is a denomination that is broadly, very broadly, in the Christian tradition, but obviously not part of classical Christianity because they're Unitarian. In other words, they deny the Trinity. They believe God is a unity completely with no distinctions in persons. This is much like the Jews' view of God. That would put them outside of the pale for classical Christianity. And she said, well, does this mean that they, since they are essentially in a different religion, that now they're going to hell? And some of you might remember that, oh, maybe it was a year or two ago, I wrote an article for those receiving our free training material through the mail entitled, I think we called it the big question, or that question, or that one question, or that tough question, or whatever. You get the point. There is a question that is just hard to address directly because I can't answer that question, yes or no, and still communicate the truth. Of course, there is a truth of the matter, that if Jesus is the only way of salvation and you are a member of a religious tradition who denies Jesus in a way that disqualifies you from what he offers, then, you know, you're lost. That's the simple fact of the matter. But saying it like that is wildly confusing for nonbelievers. And I mentioned this to the young lady who asked the question. She, I think, was a follower of Christ, but has family members that are Unitarians. And I said, there's a mistaken understanding here. And let me see if I can make it clear to you. When God looks down at the world, he doesn't see religious clubs. He doesn't see the Christians and the Muslims and the Jews and the Hindus and the Buddhists and all the other facts, sections, denominations, whatever. It isn't as if God is saying, you know, I see all these religious clubs and I like those guys over there called Christians, and so to hell with the rest of you, quite literally. That's the way it sounds, by the way, when we say Jesus is the only way. If you believe in Jesus, you go to heaven. If you don't believe in Jesus, you go to hell. True statements, both, but I think radically confusing. It sounds like that. God's just picking sides. He's choosing a club, at least from our perspective, and we are trying to just dismiss and disqualify all the other religious clubs capriciously because we don't like them. We just like to be the ones most favored by God. And it's nothing like that at all, not if you properly understand the work of the cross. It's more like, as I explained, God is not seeing any clubs. He just sees human beings who have either kept his law or haven't. Now, if you have kept God's law perfectly, you have nothing to fear. You don't need to have any religious beliefs of any kind, actually. These aren't requirements. Just do what's right in every circumstance, and you're safe. Now, some might pick at this for a moment and say, oh, well, wait a minute. Isn't like some of your beliefs and believing in God and honoring God part of doing what's right? Yeah, you're right about that. So the point I'm making is it's not a matter of clubs. It's a matter of whether we keep God's law or not. And for those who didn't keep God's law, which is all of us, less one, and that one, of course, would be Jesus of Nazareth, then we have to pay for the crimes that we've committed before him, such as they are. Unless, of course, we've availed ourselves of the gift of forgiveness that he makes possible for us. And if we do that, if we take the clemency that he offers, if we take the pardon that he makes available, then we are under the clemency that he offers and we are safe, or as some people put it, saved. And if we ignore the free offer of clemency, then we are without it. If we say no to the pardon, then we are not pardoned, and we stand in our own capabilities and by our own merits before God to judge us. Now, this is not going to be a pretty picture. And all one has to think about is just, let's say, the basic rules, like the basic 10, and just start going through them. And that would be the Ten Commandments, by the way, for you newcomers. And see how well you fare. And that's also not a pretty picture. And the thing is, if we are going to stand by ourselves, we are going to get what we ask for, to be judged according to our own efforts and our own merits. And there, then whenever we've broken the law, we will be called to account for that. And the good stuff doesn't balance out the bad stuff. Law doesn't work that way. We're supposed to do the good stuff. We're supposed to keep the law. And when we break the law, we're in trouble. And so this is what I tried to explain. And now if you're a Unitarian and God offers to the Unitarian Jesus, who is his divine son, who has paid for the crimes of the world, the Unitarian says no. No, he's not God's divine son. No, he's not the savior of the world. No, he's not the one that pays for everybody's sin. No, 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 no. These are all rejections of the offer. So when somebody rejects the offer, there's nothing left but to stand on their own merit. And that's what God cares about. Now, as it turns out, we call those people who accept the offer of forgiveness and therefore follow Christ, Christ followers or Christians. But it isn't in virtue of the fact that they are part of a little religious clique here, a club that God favors, that they get God's special favor. I like those Christian folk over there, not too hot on the Buddhists. No, that isn't the point. You stand before God on your merits, and if you fail, you either need forgiveness or you get what you got coming to you. And we've all failed miserably, more than we know. And God graciously offers us forgiveness. And if we reject it, there is no other alternative. Which is why, by the way, Jesus is the only way. He's the only one to solve the problem. He is the only antidote to a spiritual disease called sin. Anyway, that might help you out. 1-800-227-5278 in the 714 area code, 754-4150. Let's go to the phones. And in Colorado, Kevin, you're number one today. Hi, Kev.
Hi, Greg. Good to talk to you.
Thank you. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. I have a question. I've read your little booklet called Try Before You Buy, The Case for Premarital Chastity.
Yes.
And also studied the topic a few times in various groups, and the topic being what is the support for the fact that Christians should not have sex before marriage?
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, it's strange to me that it seems like it's not that clear-cut of a case. And I know I must be missing something.
Okay, well, part of it you need – there are a couple things that are clues. Keep in mind that the first century wasn't the 21st century. And so all of those things that are kind of pressing things and that are right up front here – that are the moral issues of the age, we can't read them back into the text in the same way, such that writers of the text, if they were writing now, might speak one way, they were speaking in a different way then. So if they were writing today, maybe they would address the abortion issue more in a straightforward fashion. That's another one of those things that people say, why isn't there more in the Bible about that kind of thing? Or maybe more aggressively homosexuality or whatever. But even in that time, that Jesus didn't take on the slavery issue, which was a big deal back then. And I think one of the reasons it doesn't address it quite so much is in the community that Jesus found himself is there were fairly strict religious standards.
Okay.
So now you do have terms like sexual immorality or pornea. Which is the Greek word that refers to that, and it entailed all kinds of different things. Notice that Paul talks about impurity and things like that, that you abstain from 1 Thessalonians 4. Now, this is God's will for you, that you abstain from sexual immorality, all right? Now, what was sexual immorality? Well, let's look at it this way. The Bible speaks very highly about sex. When it speaks about it, except for when it's misused. And every single time it speaks about sex in a negative fashion, it is always talking about sex with someone other than one's spouse. So you have adultery, you have homosexuality, you have fornication, you have bestiality. What else? I think that's about it. These are the things that are disqualified. All of the positive role models are heterosexual role models that are one man, one woman, basically. And in fact, Jesus himself says this. From the beginning, it's been one man, one woman, and the two become one flesh. And that's a reference to sexuality in part. And what God has joined together, let no man put asunder. So you see this this union between a man and a woman who then have, in this committed relationship, it's just those two, have a sexual bond, which relationship, therefore, should never be separated. And in fact, one of the legitimate reasons for divorce that Jesus points out is when that unique and special union has been violated by adultery.
Sure.
And so these are the kinds of ways, this is the line of argument, if you will. These are the kinds of things that seem to be relevant to this broader question. We don't have, you know, all these other freedoms of sexual expression that are expressed there in the New Testament. In fact, it seems quite the opposite.
I see.
Does that seem? Now, one other thing that really resonated with me when I was a single Christian, which I was for almost 48 years, if you might know, is when I went back to the book of Proverbs. So this is a big deal for me, right? So this is very real, single for a long time. And I was celibate for about 25 years. That was not easy, by the way, but it is possible. It's doable. And one of the things that helped me is I was convinced about this issue. And I went back to the Proverbs, and I'm looking for it right now. I can't get to it so quickly. In the early chapters of Proverbs, here it is, chapter 5, verse 15, drink water from your own cistern and fresh water from your own well. Should your springs be dispersed abroad, streams of water in the streets, let them be yours alone and not for strangers with you. What is he talking about? Water and streams and wells? No, this is a metaphor, which he clarifies in the next verse. Let your fountain be blessed and rejoice in the wife of your youth. As a loving hind and a graceful doe, let her breasts satisfy you at all times. Whose? Hers.
Right.
Be exhilarated always with her love and not that of an adulteress and or embracing the bosom of a foreigner. And the point there is, it seems to me pretty clear that God's intention for sexuality is one man and one woman who are intimate in that way, and that's it.
What passage was that, Greg?
This is in Proverbs chapter 5, verse 15 and following.
Okay.
Then he talks about some of the problems. He says, hey, look at the ways of a man are before the eyes of the Lord. He watches all his paths. God's watching. I mean, this is what the writer is saying. And also, he talks about the consequences in verse 22 and 23 of living this way. And there's more consequences in the book of Proverbs. This is just stupid, the writer of Proverbs is saying. Not only is it immoral, it's stupid. God designed things in a certain way. And I went into some detail in that book, Try Before You Buy, ? I actually haven't read that in a long time, but some more details there that this is not just simply a moral issue. There are very, very practical elements that are involved here too.
Right. Somebody pointed out to me in 1 Corinthians 7 where Paul talks about how it's better to get married than to burn with passion.
Yeah, let me hold on just a minute. I'm over break. Let me come back to you, okay? And then we'll take the second leg. Greg Kokel here at Stand to Reason. Stay with us, please. We've talked for a long time at STR about the importance of the tactical approach for an ambassador for Jesus Christ. Instead of finding yourself flat-footed and intimidated in conversations about your faith and values, you can increase your confidence and your skill in discussions, no matter who you're talking to, by using sound tactics in defending your faith. But now you can help others learn the material, too, by using the brand new, unique, interactive training tool, Tactics in Defending the Faith Interactive DVD for Small Groups. As a group leader, you can help your small group learn specific skills to initiate conversations effortlessly, stop challengers in their tracks, and turn the tables, graciously and effectively expose faulty thinking, maneuver through minefields, present the truth clearly, cleverly, and persuasively. Included in the set are 6 one-hour interactive sessions on DVD with discussions, role-playing, self-assessment quizzes, recall exercises, memory tools, games, competition, all to help you learn more effectively. You'll also receive comprehensive leader and student manuals that are included in PDF form for printing and for copying for your group. You'll have everything you need to lead a group to be stronger and better equipped to skillfully present their faith. And it's plug and play. The DVD does all the work. That's Tactics in Defending the Faith Interactive DVD for Small Groups. It's $49.95 and includes two DVDs and one data CD. Order it at str.org or call 1-800, the number 2, and the word reason.
Does the Christian faith stand up to the scrutiny of critics? Tough scrutiny? How credible is the Bible, and how seriously should you take it? Can you entrust your eternity to its message? Based on Lee Strobel's provocative national TV program, the new DVD series, Faith Under Fire, features fascinating debates and riveting interviews with Christians, atheists, Muslims, and proponents of other faiths as they tackle today's hottest spiritual topics. Lee Strobel concludes each session by offering his own perspective. These two new DVDs, now available from Standard Reason, include discussions on, is the supernatural real? Is Jesus a prophet or the Son of God? Do all roads lead to God? Did Jesus rise from the dead? And more interesting topics. Guests include skeptic Michael Shermer, critics Edward Tabash, Richard Carrier, and Shabir Ali. Defenders of Christianity include Dr. J.P. Moreland, Dr. William Lade Craig, Greg Kokel, and Stephen Meyer. Contact Stand to Reason at str.org or 800-2-REASON to order these fascinating DVDs.
Greg Kokel back with you. Stand to Reason is the show, ladies and gentlemen. Clear Thinking Christianity. And congratulations to Dave Williamson of Santa Rosa, California. He's the Frapper winner this week, and if you're a podcaster and you haven't, planted your flags, as it were, you can do that by going to our website at str.org, and there in the lower left-hand corner, punch the podcast icon, and a map will come up if you let it materialize long enough, depending how fast your server is. And it's a place where you can indicate where you live as a listener to Stand to Reason, and you are you can identify yourself as a member of the community. And, of course, if you do that, then you will be registered to be in the drawing for a free gift. Every week we do that from our registered community. Dave Williamson from Santa Rosa, California, is the one who won this week, and will be sending a free gift from Stand to Reason product, usually a relativism book signed by yours truly. So, Dave, congratulations. And Santa Rosa, it seems to me we've had another winner from wine country in Northern California there recently. So that must be the hot spot right now. All right, back to the phone calls. And we're talking with Kevin in Colorado. And, Kevin, you had a follow-up question about the premarital sex question from the New Testament.
Yeah, I guess I just wondered what your thought was, your opinion is on using 1 Corinthians 7, 8, verse 8 and 9. To support the idea that premarital sex is not acceptable. Where Paul seems
1 Corinthians 7, I'm looking at verse 8 and 9. I say to the unmarried and to widows that it is good for them if they remain even as I, but if they do not have self-control, let them marry, for it's better to marry than to burn.
Right.
Okay, so of course the burn there in verse 9 is to burn in sexual passion. And this relates to the issue of sexual self-control, because this whole first section of chapter 7 is about sex, particularly as it relates to marriage. And I think that fits as well. Paul says, look, some people can go single, and it's like, and that's great, because then they have undistracted devotion to the Lord, right? But some people, when you're single, and this is more like me, it's undevoted distraction, you know, it's hard. You don't have the gift. And he said, look, if you're a person that is distracted and you are sexually burning, then it's appropriate for you to fulfill that desire in the way that God designed it to be fulfilled. And that would be by getting married. So rather than kind of flaring up and burning out in passion, it is better to get married than to do that. And he's identifying the appropriate provision that God has for our sexual expression to be the wife that God, that the woman that you marry, or the man that you marry, your spouse, put simply. Does that make sense?
That makes great sense.
Okay, best of luck on that one.
Thanks very much.
Appreciate your call. It's a challenging issue if you're young. And, boy, this is one of the areas where people want to really try hard to find the exceptions. All right. Let's go to Dallas and Daniel. Daniel, welcome to Stand to Reason. How you doing?
I'm doing good. Thank you, Greg, for taking my call.
Sure.
I was talking to a friend of mine who happens to be Muslim.
Yeah.
And she basically gave the argument that the God of the Old Testament was the same as the God of Islam. And I don't know a whole lot about Islam. I've never read the Quran, so I didn't really know how to respond to her.
Well, why would she say it's the same?
She was saying that Abraham, she was mentioning Abraham's faith, and saying that basically that Muslims believe the same God as the Old Testament.
Well, if the Muslims are worshiping the same God as the Old Testament, then why are Muslims persecuting the Jews who believe in the same God of the Old Testament?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a fair question, it seems to me.
Yeah.
The answer to this, generally, sometimes the question is raised that the God of the Bible is the same God as the God of the Quran, and this is false when you take the full testimony into consideration,
mm-hmm.
because the God of the Bible, Jesus God, for example, had a son. And there is no son of God in Islam. And in fact, if you claim that Jesus had a son, then you are committing the most heinous sin of Islam, and that's the sin of shirk.
Yeah.
All right? That's equating any physical thing or any created thing with God, or identifying God with any contingent or created thing.
Yeah, I gave an argument for the deity of Christ and for the death, burial, and resurrection of Christ, and she kind of counted that as false, just no argument, and said he was only a prophet and he has no deity.
Well, see, this is the point where you say, well, thank you, now you agree with me. That we are talking about a different religious system when I talk about Jesus and God from the Bible and you talk about Jesus and God from the Quran. You know, my very first day as a paid broadcaster in 1990, my guest was a Muslim from the Islamic Information League, Hassan Hathout.
Uh-huh.
And he kept saying that they believed in Jesus. But every time I talk about something about Jesus, he'd deny it. And finally, I realized what was going on halfway through the show, that they believe in the Jesus of the Quran, not the Jesus of the Bible.
Yeah.
And they will agree with the Jesus of the Bible insofar as it does not contradict the Jesus of the Quran, that is, the portrait of Jesus painted by Muhammad. And if it does contradict it, and it does so at the critical junctures that you identified, being the Son of God, being the Messiah, being raised from the dead, that kind of thing, crucified. They don't even believe Jesus was crucified on the cross. And being the Savior of all mankind. They disagree with all of that because the Quran says differently. And as I pointed out to a Muslim gentleman that I was talking to, why would you trust what Muhammad says about Jesus? Because Muhammad was born in 570. He was born like 600 years after Jesus. Would you rather trust something that was written by someone 600 years after the fact or something by someone who actually lived with the principle in question?
Yeah.
John or whoever, you know, Matthew, some of these disciples that were proximal to the events and had first-person access to Jesus, and they made these comments. Which is the most reliable testimony? And, I mean, it seems to make most sense that the Gospels are going to be more reliable as being accurate, all things being equal.
Okay.
But all things aren't equal in this discussion. I hope you understand that.
Yeah.
The Muslims, much like many Christians, just spout the party line and give the religious slogans and punch it out there and expect that that's all you need to say is the party line is it's the same God, Jesus is one of God's prophets, and Muhammad is the final and the greatest prophet. And so Jesus is cool. In fact, there's more said about much more said about Jesus in the Quran than about Muhammad himself. But it is the prophet's own take on Jesus. It is not consistent with what the Gospels have to say about Jesus.
Okay.
So there are two
sorry to interrupt.
No, very quickly, two issues here. One is, what are the facts of the matter? And the facts are, is we're talking about a different God and a different Jesus. Maybe they're right and we're wrong. Maybe we're wrong and they're right, but we're not both right. We're not both talking about the same thing. So let's get clear at least on that with them. And then the second one is, how do you know which one's the most reliable account? And I think an appeal just to the facts themselves shows that it's probably more likely that the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, are going to be more reliable than Muhammad writing in a different continent 600 years later.
Yeah. What would be an Old Testament argument against the about God being the same?
Yeah, this is a little. I think this is a little bit harder. And what you have to do, the only reason is because if you take strictly the Old Testament, you don't have Jesus in the picture, you don't have the Son of God, and you don't have the Trinity explicitly in the picture. I think that you can go back with the revelation of the New Testament and see what might be called hints or suggestions of the multi-personality, in a sense, the Trinity in the Old Testament. But it's certainly not explicit. And so... it's going to be more difficult here. Here's the simple way of going about this. I mean, or this is this would be the strategy. Okay, whenever you say that one thing is equal to another or identical with another, like for example, Greg Kokel is identical with the talk show host of Stand to Reason today, May 6th or whatever. You're not talking about two. You're talking about one. If Greg is identical to the talk show host, we're just talking about the same person, right?
Yeah.
Therefore, everything that is true about Greg Kokel is going to be true about the talk show host, correct?
Yes.
And if there's anything different, then we know we're not talking about the same ones. Well, all you have to do is you have to just stack up the God of Muhammad with the God of the Old Testament and look at their qualities and look at their characteristics and look at their covenants. And look at the way they reveal themselves, and you say, are these really the same God? In both systems, you have a monotheistic system. There's no question. In both systems, you have a claim that this is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But just saying so doesn't make it so, does it?
No.
If there are radical differences between the two, which it turns out there are, God is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. In the Old Testament, in other words, his covenant is with those people, and he has chosen those people out of all the peoples of the world to establish his unique covenant with and to bring the Messiah from. And that whole story, it follows true throughout the entire Hebrew Scriptures. All of a sudden, we have a competitor. We have a competitor that claims that that they're the true God. So it's a competitor. It's not the same thing. This is why the Jews and the Muslims, to some degree, are at odds with each other, because it's not the same God. It's a different system. It's a different picture of deity. They both can't be right. They could both be wrong, but they both can't be talking about the same God.
Okay.
Does that help?
Yeah, that helps. Thank you for taking that call. I appreciate that.
All right, Daniel, I appreciate the call. By the way, what I just described to you is the law of the indiscernibility of identicals. That's just a fancy philosophic way of saying that identical things are identical. And so if you find in given things that there is a claim that they're identical, any significant distinctions, then you know you're not talking about the same thing. You're talking about two separate things. All right. Let's go to Ohio and Gary. Welcome to Stand to Reason, Gary.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have your tactics CDs, and they've been fantastic.
Good.
For a while. The question is, we know Carl Sagan died in 1996, but okay. His legacy moves on.
Sure.
In the form of Anne Druyan, who is now quoted in a National Scientific Journal.
Anne Druyan was his wife, I think, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah.
Yes, sir. Uh-huh. Yes, sir. And she has a preface to some of his Gifford lecture notes in one of his books, and she says Sagan found especially tragic the notion we had been created separately from all living things. For Carl, Darwin's insight that life evolved over the eons through natural selection was not just better science than Genesis; and also afforded a deeper, more satisfying spiritual experience, quote unquote. How do we reply to that?
Well, it's hard to reply when somebody says, this answer is more satisfying for me. I mean, think about it. That's like saying, I like strawberries and I don't like spinach. You know, how do you say? Well, you can say, well, spinach is better for you. That's okay. It doesn't taste better. And I'm talking about how it tastes. I'd be curious why this would be more satisfying spiritually for him. By the way, as a naturalist or a physicalist, materialist, and I'm not sure where his full commitments were philosophically, but generally, people of this ilk are full-fledged materialists. That means the only thing that's real is physical stuff. And if that's the case, then what sense do we make out of the kind of claim that this is more satisfying spiritually for me? There is no spiritual dimension in physicalism, so how is this more satisfying spiritually? So even his comment seems to bear testimony to the legitimacy of a spiritual dimension that cannot be explained in Darwinian terms, since Darwinian is, by definition, a materialistic process. Does that make sense to you?
Oh, yes, on the spiritual side. But let's say the first part of that, being created separately from all living things. So contrary, he's saying, or she's saying, that we're created all from the same thing, whether you're an animal or a kangaroo or a...
Right. Well, that would be their view. I always saw that as a liability. He thinks it's a virtue.
Right.
He's saying it is somehow... Let's just get rid of the spiritual word right now because that doesn't make so much sense in his worldview. Let's just say he's just expressing his emotions. It is just more emotionally satisfying for me to think that I'm one with the animal kingdom in that I am merely a member of the animal kingdom and there is nothing different between me and any other creature. I have a familial kinship. We are all the same metaphysically here. What's the appeal to that? Animals act like animals. And we fault human beings for acting like animals. Implicit in that is that human beings are not merely animals. We have a physical nature. But we don't encourage people to pursue their animal instincts such as they are. We expect them to restrain themselves, which animals aren't really capable of doing very well, based on moral concerns. Now, moral concerns also are not physical things. They are non-physical realities, if they are realities.
And in a scientific journal, excuse me, they're sure. Trying to say, well, we prove everything by science, but how do you get these individuals to understand that we have a soul, that a non-material entity, which wasn't evolved or anything like that?
Right. Well, this is kind of, I'm kind of beating around the bush a little bit here. And I'm saying, first of all, if somebody just says it's more satisfying emotionally, that's hard to deal with. But I'm asking, why would it be so satisfying to acknowledge that you're just an animal? And I am not going to prove this scientifically. I'm going to do some reflection here. And the reason is because the only thing you could prove scientifically, even in principle, is how physical things fit together. What you can't give any credence to through scientific analysis is anything that has to do with value, virtue, vice, meaning, substance, in that regard. All right? These are completely non-spirituality. These are completely non-physical things. It doesn't mean that they're not legitimate or true, it means that science can't speak to them. Now, the irony I'm pointing out is here's a guy who wants to just follow science, but then he's talking about what's more satisfying to him spiritually. And so, therefore, he acknowledges a spiritual element for which his worldview has no explanation. He also wants to say, well, it's more satisfying because we're all animals. But isn't it odd because most of us value civilization? And part of civilization entails that we don't live like animals. And the reason we don't live like animals is we restrain ourselves morally, which morals have no scientific basis, but we find them to be quite important and valuable. And so most people want to distance themselves from the animal kingdom, where he wants to identify himself with the animal kingdom. And I'm wondering, what is it that he could possibly find satisfying in saying that he's the same as an animal and nothing more.
Well, then that gives them a freedom to, you know, do anything he wants to. Everything is okay then.
Well, he doesn't actually believe that. And, you know, because obviously he faults other people for promoting views that he thinks are false, you know, which he argued against. This is the trick here. I'm going to have to run here in a second because I'm way over time. But the trick is people like that want to have their cake and eat it too. They want to talk. They want to talk up materialism and evolution and all that, but they don't want to let go of the things that are so valuable that can only be grounded in an entirely different worldview. Gary, thank you for your call, and when we get back, I'll say a little bit more about that. I got to run to break right now, and I'll be back in just a moment right here on Stand to Reason.
Tired of defending your faith with "the Bible says so," "does too," or "I think it does"? Do you remove yourself from conversations with friends and coworkers about sensitive subjects like abortion and homosexuality? Stop being unprepared and call today for the latest issue of Solid Ground, the bi-monthly newsletter of Stand to Reason. This free publication is filled with practical information and useful tools to help you articulate your faith and have a biblically grounded understanding of subjects like same-sex marriage, evolution, stem cell research, and partial birth abortion. Don't be embarrassed or unprepared when you stand up as a Christian ambassador. Simply pick up the phone and call Stand to Reason today at 1-800-2-REASON. In each issue of Solid Ground, Greg Kogel teaches you how to represent your faith as an ambassador of Christ in a concise and attractive yet effective manner. Learn tactics tempered with wisdom that make your beliefs persuasive, not naive. So contact us today at 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON. Or visit us on the web at www.str.org. Ask for the latest copy of Solid Ground to be sent to you today. It's free when you call 1-800-2-REASON.
The dictionary defines the word expand this way: a verb, to open up, to unfold, to increase the extent, number, volume, or scope of. Stand to Reason's focus in 2007 is expanding horizons, a goal born out of our desire to increase your understanding of what it means to be Christ's ambassador, and to open up the riches of truth in new ways, and explore new ways to be more effective as an ambassador for Christ. No conference is better at doing that than our annual Master Series in Christian Thought. This year's lineup of speakers will challenge you to expand your horizons as you face the pressures of being a Christian in today's world. These extraordinary minds will broaden and deepen your understanding of truth amidst an antagonistic and divisive culture. Never has the need been greater for Christians who confidently and competently defend what they believe. You can order the lectures individually, or even better, you can benefit from the entire series. Dr. J.P. Moreland, Dr. James Emery White, Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse, and our own Greg Kokel and Alan Schliemann. Visit str.org or call 800-2-REASON to order this series that will expand your horizons.
Demonstrating once again that Christianity is something worth thinking about, Greg Kokel here on Stand to Reason, giving you something worth thinking about, hopefully every weekend. Sundays 3 until 5. Hour number 2 coming up, my guest Hugh Hewitt, Craig Hazen, John Mark Reynolds. We'll have a massive amount of luminosity here in the studio. I don't know how I'm going to control all of these guys all at once, but we'll be talking about Hugh's new book, A Mormon in the White House. That coming up, hour number 2, so stay with us. Just wanted to let you know, tomorrow, that'll be Monday the 7th, I'll be at Saddleback Church in Lake Forest, California at 7 p.m. I'm going to be teaching there on the Columbo Tactic. It's a special course to help the people of that church maneuver more in conversations with others about Christ. And, of course, the Columbo Tactic, I think, is one of the most effective ways of doing that. One of my favorite things to teach, I'll be there at Saddleback at 7 p.m. You can go to www.saddleback.net if you want information on how to get there. And then following up Wednesday the 9th, that's 2 days later, I'll be at Emmanuel Faith Church in Escondido, California, down in northern San Diego County, also at 7 o'clock. They're doing a series on science and faith and evolution. And it says here the topic is science and faith, are they compatible? Is that really my topic, or is it why I'm not an evolutionist? It's this one here. Oh, it's why I'm not an evolutionist. Okay, so in any event, I'll be talking about that particular issue and giving you my arguments against Darwinian macroevolution that evening. Emmanuel Faith at 7 p.m. If you go to our website and punch at str.org and punch my face, you'll see an area for my schedule, and the calendar has all the information about the events that I'm doing. So I just wanted to let you know that. I want to follow up here on Gary's call before I go to some of the other callers. Do we still have Gary? No, Gary's in Ohio. He's gone. And this has to do with the whole science project vis-a-vis the Christian project. And I want you to be aware of something here, and that is that science is a materialistic enterprise. I mean, that should go without saying. But it has some ramifications for discussions about faith and religion. Since science is a materialistic enterprise, that is, it measures the material world, not the immaterial world or anything in the immaterial world, if there even is such a thing for the sake of discussion, they simply assume there isn't and just measure the physical world, and that's the end of it. Okay, fair enough. But if they just measure the physical world, they can't, on the one hand, claim that since science hasn't found it, it doesn't exist, like souls, for example, because science is not geared to find things like souls. In fact, I wrote a piece a couple of years ago called Weighing a Chicken with a Yardstick, which you can't do, can you? Because yardsticks were meant to measure, not weigh. But this doesn't mean that the chicken doesn't have a weight. It has... It may have a weight, but you have to find use something else to find out that. In the same way, science is meant to measure the physical, not the immaterial world, and therefore it can't render any appropriate conclusions about the nature of the non-physical world. It doesn't go there. So you can't render conclusions about the non-existence of the non-physical realm simply because science hasn't found any evidence for it. It's not capable of doing it. Secondly, it seems to me you are out of line if you help yourself to all of these non-physical things that you like that are the province of a different worldview and has no home in a materialistic worldview. Things like spirituality and morality and meaning and significance and all of those things, which, by the way, are thick in the writings of people like Sagan, even though they are completely materialistic in their outlook. So what I try to do is not to try to prove the existence of the soul through science, because the soul, I think, can be demonstrated to exist, but not that way. You try to use the appropriate means of proving immaterial things, and then you also point out all of the times that the materialist is actually borrowing from your worldview in the comments that he's making, which seems to indicate that he actually does believe in the immaterial world, at least implicitly, because of the way he's talking. And this is something that I do often in debates. I can recommend a book for you, and not only a book, but a tape that we have. I've done a teaching on this called The Invisible Man, and you can get it at str.org, and it is my argument for the existence of a soul, and I think it's a good one. I have borrowed heavily from one of my mentors, J.P. Moreland, who has written a book with Gary Habermas entitled Beyond Death. And in this book, Beyond Death by Habermas and Moreland, both pursue their respective disciplines to make a case for the existence of the soul and for the afterlife. Gary Habermas, by the way, does an exceptional job of deftly handling the near-death experience documentation to demonstrate not so much that we have proof that heaven exists from that documentation, but we do have very, very conclusive proof that there is consciousness after all physical activities in the body are ceased, physical activities of every kind. And this is quite powerful evidence against materialism, which I think is the best use of the near-death experience evidence. So there's something a little bit more for you, Gary, and the rest of you who are interested in that kind of thing. Let's go to Linda in Whittier. Linda, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Thank you. Before I say anything, I'd like to say I don't mean to be offensive by this, but I read today that Dr. Francis Beckwith had returned to his Roman Catholic roots. And I read all of the comments on the blog and so forth. And all I heard were these really deep, esoteric minutia of this Reformation or that council. But nobody asked the question, is how can a evangelical decide to start to worship idols, pray to saints? Every place I've ever seen in the Bible, in, you know, we are forbidden to do that. When Saul did it, he lost his kingdom.
Right. All right, let me respond briefly to this. And this is news that I heard a couple of days as well, that Frank and Frankie, his wife, had been, in a sense, reconfirmed in the Roman Catholic Church there in Waco, Texas. I actually have not talked to Frank directly about this. Melinda has. I can confirm that what you've heard is true. Here's what we need to caution against, presuming certain beliefs and content based on this move. Frank still considers himself an evangelical, and he said that he hasn't really changed any of his core beliefs at all. This is my understanding. But I don't want to speak out of turn. Frank is a dear friend, and I want to give Frank a chance to make his own statement, which he hasn't done publicly yet.
Yes, he has. He rewrote it on his blog.
Oh, he has. Well, that's just recent then.
Yeah, I read it this morning.
Oh, okay. Well, then
I wouldn't have ever brought gossip to you.
No. Well, it's not gossip. Ever since Sunday last, they had a public ceremony in which they did this, and I was, to be honest with you, quite surprised when I heard it.
Right.
What I'm trying to do is figure out is what to make of this, and I haven't read Frank's blog. I didn't know it was up, but I'd like to have Frank here on the air. And since he's been on this program many, many times, and he's a dear friend, as is Frankie.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons I called you.
Yeah, and so I want to ask him exactly what is it that you now embrace with regards to classic Roman Catholic doctrine. And I would be very, very surprised if any of the things that you mentioned are part of his spiritual repertoire.
Well,
for some of the reasons
that's what it sounded like.
Okay, well, I can't.
So maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I misunderstood him.
Well, I can't say irony on that because I haven't read that. So, I just don't know what to say. I can't tell you right now one way or another, and I don't want to try to second guess Frank. I don't think it'd be kind to him. I'll have to read it myself and then try to figure out my take on that and talk to him.
Okay.
And like I said, what we're gonna try to do is if he wants to, to give him a chance to clarify on our show some of the thoughts that he has, and then we'll go from there. All right.
Okay. When do you think you'll be addressing?
You know, this is hard to say because my schedule is really, really crazy the next few weeks. But we'll just.
I'll be watching your blog and your website.
Okay, I appreciate that. Thanks a lot for the call. Yeah, I just want to reaffirm that Frank and I are close friends, and actually talked to him about a week ago, but not on this issue. And so I don't want to second guess him, and I haven't seen the blog that he posted. Have you seen this, Melinda? No. So we are not privy to the particulars and the details of what he had to say, and we'll just have to follow up on that. And I do hope that we can have a chance to have him on the air and just have him answer for himself about his own views. But I do want to reinforce that what he told us is that he still considers himself an evangelical, and that there hasn't been any significant changes and his theological beliefs, foundational theological beliefs, but he has aligned himself with the Roman Catholic Church, and that's all I know at this particular point. So, all right, let's go to Raleigh, North Carolina. Thomas, hi, welcome to Stand to Reason. Good. We just got a few minutes here. What's on your mind?
I've got a quick question. I've been reading your article about preaching God's love in the Book of Acts.
Yes.
And really,
or the absence of the preaching of God's love in the Book of Acts, to be more accurate, right?
Yes, that's correct. And, you know, really appreciated the research that you guys did on that. And wanted to know, what application does that study have for us? You know, obviously it being a different culture and time than we live in now, I think, you know, obviously the message of forgiveness is the same. But, like you said, the absence of preaching God's love, what you know, what application should we do?
Well, I think that the culture then and the culture now are just as interested in God's love. You know, I don't think that that change or that all that, that difference is such a significant difference on the one hand. I think that's a fair question to ask when you're facing these kinds of things. Gee, what's the best way to contextualize the gospel? But I just made an observation. There is a way that we do this that I am concerned is not entirely productive because it doesn't tell the story that is important to understand why Jesus was here in the first place. It's kind of like the four spiritual laws with the first law and the third and the fourth law, and the two middle laws are missing, if you know that characterization of the gospel. And that's a problem. You know, God loves you and has a wonderful plan for your life, and receive Jesus, and then you can experience that wonderful plan for your life. But the two laws in the middle, that we are separated from God, that's missing, that we need to receive Christ, that's missing. And so my question is this. In the book of Acts, they had one way of communicating the gospel, and these were the people that were trained by Jesus himself. And nowadays, we have a very different way of it. Who do you think is correct? I think probably the mistake wasn't with the first century. It's with the 21st century. All right, that's all the time I have. Thomas, thank you for your call and this hour coming up. Hugh Hewitt, Craig Hazen, John Mark Reynolds, and as one untimely born, yours truly, in the next hour on A Mormon in the White House, we'll talk about it. Greg Kokelund, Stand to Reason. Stay with us.
Where's heaven?
That actually happened to me, if you can imagine. I think this is the same kid, the one who asked me, where's heaven? He's the same one. He said, what's a soul? I mean, kids say the darndest things, right? Well, those were good questions, but they're hard to answer, especially with a kid like that. Because my little two-year-old's going to be asking those kind of questions before too long. Hour number two here at Stand to Reason. And I have a luminous set of guests as part of my show today, although they're not all here. The election season, the election cycle has begun already way early for the year. And, you know, in, I guess the Republican field is thick with candidates, and one of them is a Mormon. And this troubles many in the base. And so we've devoted this hour to talk about that. A Mormon in the White House is the book by Hugh Hewitt. And Mr. Hewitt's not here yet. So, but we had a whole group of people that were part of our broadcast. And so he will probably be arriving in a few minutes. We can start without him. We're going to start the party without him because I have also in studio Dr. Craig Hazen. Craig is the founder or the director of the apologetics program, the master's program in apologetics over there at Biola, and a long-term friend of Stand to Reason. How long have you been with us now, Craig, on our board at Stand to Reason?
My goodness, what, 12, 15 years?
Just kind of like almost forever. Yeah. So you've been an important part of the team here. And plus, your PhD was done in the area of these many different religions that kind of sprung out of the burned out area of New York back in the 19th century. Mormonism was one of those.
Yeah, it's a fascinating time. And one doesn't have to look at Mormonism long to discover that it's actually evolved over time. And we're looking at a new kind of Mormonism today. Hey, Hugh, how you doing?
Yeah, welcome to the show, Hugh.
You know, in commercial radio, it starts at 6 minutes after the hour, Greg. Thank you. Hi, Craig.
It's great to have you. I was just telling the audience that we had all these luminaries here, but one of them hasn't showed up yet. Your new book, A Mormon in the White House, 10 Things Every American Should Know About Mitt Romney. This is the talk of the town right now. It's just moving to the top of the charts, as I understand.
It has had a great open. It opened on the New York Times bestseller list, fell back, climbing back up again. And interesting aside about your other guest, Craig Hazen. You know, you write a book, you're very proud of it. You like.
We actually have three guests here. One's not in the studio, the other one's hanging online. John Mark Reynolds.
Oh.
Hi, John Mark.
Hi, it's good to two of my favorite people in studio there with you, and
Greg, this is just more fun than we should be allowed to have on radio.
Yeah, I agree. I've been trying to think how I'm going to control you guys. John Mark Reynolds, the founder of the storied Tories Honors program there at Talbot, and a brilliant man. Stranger to talk radio, been on his show quite a number of times, and we've got this kind of tough issue we're going to knock around a little bit today. Insofar as my audience is largely followers of Jesus Christ, there's a big election coming up, and how would you rate this election coming up as in terms of its importance?
Well, I've
said
this in 2000 and 2004, the most important elections of my lifetime. Yeah. I'm going to keep saying it until the Islamic jihadists are gone, because you know we could leave the studio and find out a massive attack has happened anywhere in the free world. Today, they killed 56 innocents in Iraq. They just as soon kill 560 or 5,600 or 56,000 in the United States if they could.
Yeah, so there's a lot on the line in this
election. With the Supreme Court, with a 5-4 look at that, we've got a lot going on.
Yeah, and a couple of Supreme Court justices could be stepping down in the next few years.
Yes.
The old time on the liberal side of the bench, as it were. So we got a lot going on here, and that's why this election is so important. Now, I need to make a very clear disclaimer here, and the disclaimer here is that nothing that I have to say today should be construed as an endorsement of any candidate, because as far as I'm concerned, this is not about who you vote for, not our discussion here today. You guys can talk about that if you want, but that's not my part. I care about what followers of Jesus Christ think in the voting process and the way they make their decision. I want to talk about what kind of considerations are legitimate, regardless of who the candidate happens to be. And in this particular case, how should Christians consider the question of voting for a Mormon in public office? And, of course, that's the topic of your book. You were saying something about
glad you're going to do this, because you're going to model for the rest of the media how to do this. I just came from the Fox News Channel, an appalling interview where the host asked me if the Mountain Meadows Massacre should come up in the course of the Romney candidacy.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And I said, well, only if we bring up Calvin's presiding over the execution of Servetus or Urban VIII's imprisonment of Galileo with regards to Giuliani and the former McCain's Presbyterian. What I started to say was there's an appendix in the book, which is my conversation with Craig and John Mark about this issue.
This is why we wanted you all together.
Yeah.
So I can take a vacation now.
You could go away. Actually, we could just read it out loud, because I got a call from Mark DeMoss, who's a tremendous advocate for the church out there in the world, the evangelical church. Mm-hmm. He represented the Billy Graham Association.
DeMoss Foundation guy.
DeMoss Foundation guy. He runs the DeMoss Group out of Atlanta. And he said, you would I'm feeling pretty good. I like the book a lot. Would Gregory mind if I reprinted the appendix with Craig and John Mark Reynolds? I said, no, go right ahead. Yeah. Skip the rest of the book, Mark. But that's because they talk about how this is both an obligation and an opportunity, an obligation to be respectful of our fellow citizens and their beliefs. And we do not believe what Mormons believe, obviously not. Yeah. But how to do it the right way.
Interesting you mentioned the Mountain Meadows Massacre. I think people are fresh off of watching that PBS series, which was very well viewed, I think. I think it had good ratings for a PBS special. It was very well done. But Mountain Meadows played a prominent role, and the Mormons aren't particularly happy about that.
Right.
And I wouldn't either if I had a grisly episode in my own history. But this is already playing out something I think we were predicting early on, that this is not necessarily good for Mormonism, that there's a Mormon candidate drawing attention to Mormonism.
No, it's not.
If history plays itself out again, as public attention focuses on the LDS, we might actually see some transmogrification among the LDS.
Meaning for the rest of us plebs here.
Yeah.
That's good Calvin and Hobbes lingo, Greg. Transmogrify.
Yeah.
I think under pressure, when they go public, insular groups tend to modify and become, more mainstream. And so I think that some of my evangelical friends worry that supporting a Mormon for the White House will change evangelicals. I think it's far more likely to mainstream the more infinitely tiny group as they have to defend themselves in public. But I'll tell you this, they shouldn't have to defend 150-year-old history if they're running for president and they had nothing whatsoever to do with it. Mitt Romney would have to be 210 years old for it to be a relevant issue in this campaign.
Well, here's my concern, gentlemen, and this is what I kind of like to focus on today. I have two concerns. One, I share your view that this is a critically important election, Hugh, and for all the reasons that were mentioned here. And the second thing is what's a nice way to say this? I think Christians can tend to be sometimes a little superstitious. In other words, they make decisions for less than stellar reasons. They are moved by the wrong kinds of things. And even though Christians have, I think, the point of view that has the smart money riding on it, and this is one of the things I spoke about this morning at a local church, it's not the case that all Christians are using their smarts in the best way, which is why we have an organization like Stand to Reason to make their case in the public square. So my concern is that when they approach these kinds of questions, this election coming up, that they're going to have the wrong things influencing them. And I think that's part of what you're talking about here in this book.
It is. I think that there are very serious questions about every candidate that has to be answered. What is their character? What do they think about the issues that matter to us as believers, such as the protection of the unborn? What do they believe about religious tolerance? What do they think about the jihad? But none of those require them to do theology. In fact, I don't want them to do theology.
Right.
I think that apologists for the faith. I could listen to you and Craig talk to an LDS apologist all day long, and I would find it fascinating. And if John Mark wanted to go over to BYU and engage someone on the philosophy of how best to live, I think that would be fascinating. That's not what presidents do. Presidents
right,
make
yeah.
decisions about how to defend the country or how not mm-hmm. to, and that's what I want to know.
Yeah, let me just go on record to say that I think there's a big difference between choosing a president and choosing a pastor. This is an exercise in the former, mm-hmm. not the latter, and so different questions are being asked to make the choice. But Christians have raised objections about this as they think about the possibility of what appears to be an otherwise very qualified man being in the White House and voting for him. And Hugh, what are the reasons that you've heard, I think there are three main concerns, that Christians have given why they wouldn't vote for a Mormon?
Well, I'll run through them quickly. And I guarantee you the Stand to Reason audience, because I've been on this program before, is large. It's very responsive. It's very smart. Melinda and I have talked about this a lot. They will write you. You will get hate mail after mm-hmm. this broadcast, because we did not begin with a denunciation of all aspects of the Mormon Church.
Well, bigger problem is, just a little while ago I mentioned that tomorrow I'm going to be at Saddleback Church teaching, so we already got the flow from that particular started it already.
And the anti-Mormons, God love them, and I'm serious about this. They wish to evangelize the Mormons, but to do so in a way that I don't consider winsome at all. And I found three objections. The first objection is, the White House will be controlled from Salt Lake City. I consider that to be ludicrous. I consider that to be ludicrous because it has not been the habit. If that was the case, could they please call Harry Reid and stop him right now? Because Harry Reid is a Mormon, and if they have a master plan, it's very, very deep.
So is Orrin Hatch.
Yeah, Orrin Hatch is a Mormon. They mm-hmm. don't play in politics. They haven't for many, many years since, you know, Brigham Young was the governor of the Utah Territory. But it's not because they'd lose their tax exemption, though they would. It's because they would lose their standing as what they consider to be a worldwide church. Not one devoted to that. And I asked Mitt Romney about it specifically, a Mormon in the White House, and he said, I take an oath. The oath is to uphold the Constitution of the United States, the laws of the United States. And of course I would not be, nor would they ever ask me to do anything. Number two, it would supercharge Mormon missionary work. Now, my friend Al Mohler, friend of yours, does believe that this is a legitimate concern, that when, you know, a door is knocked upon in South America or Uganda, the fact that a Mormon is in the White House, if Mitt Romney were to win, would supercharge that. I asked Archbishop Chaput, Catholic mm-hmm. Bishop of Denver, and he said, well, that's really more of a knock on our missionary zeal than it is an indictment of theirs. We just have to be in the field. And Romney laughed it off and said, that's certainly not been the case in Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know. That one's the most legitimate. The third is, it's just too weird. Who could believe this story? You know, golden tablets, the angel Moroni. It doesn't make any sense. To which many people responded, you know, Catholics believe in Fatima, Pentecostals believe in healing. We have a belief, and I'll leave it up to Craig and John Mark to take it off, that Christians believe in the supernatural.
Mm-hmm.
That another faith believes in the supernatural is not exactly the winning hold in a wrestling match.
Yeah, let me jump in on this one, because I listened to your excellent interview with Dennis Prager the other day. In fact, I podcasted it yesterday or day before yesterday while I was running. I was listening to the whole thing. And I liked the interview. At this particular point, though, I thought there was something that a nuance needed to be made, and maybe it didn't need to be made on his show, but it certainly needs to be made on our show. Look, when those poor guys killed themselves about 10 years ago from the UFO cult. Hale Bopp, the whole thing. And Christians were saying, look at these weirdos. They believe they're going to get rescued from outer space. They're going to get new bodies. bodies. They're going to enter into a new phase of life. And I thought, hey, you know, slow down here a little bit.
Yes.
Because that's kind of like what we believe. You know, it's very, very similar. This morning I came from a church. We sang the song, The Old Wooden Cross. And this talks about blood flowing down and over us and onto other things and being cleansed by this blood. From the outside, this seems weird. But here's my concern. Is all weirdness equal? You know, there are weird beliefs in Christianity for outsiders, and there are weird beliefs in Mormonism for outsiders. Is the complaint simply that Mormon views are weird, or is it that they're odd and that they're unjustified, like maybe Christian views could be justified?
Let me take a shot at this. I've been blogging about this for the last 3 months and trying to write about this extensively, including dealing with the Comet cult. I think that in the public square, we want to be careful to draw our weirdness barrier as broadly as possible, or we're going to end up with secularists calling us all weird, and, mm-hmm. and we're going to have weirdo meters attached to each one of us.
Well, look at Mike Huckabee is a Pentecostal, for goodness sake. I mean, there's a large target if we want to go that direction. I agree with you on that.
I really think that unless we want to fall into a kind of soft bigotry where weird and weird religious views in the public square just amount to I don't like them or I don't agree with them.
It's the other guy that's weird.
That there's a pretty easy threefold test for the public square, and it's does the view that I think is weird have any public policy implications? Mm-hmm. So, for example, suppose a religion has you wear special headgear, or in my case, I wear a baptismal cross where I go as a symbol of faith following my baptism. That's not something that most people do. That's not something that secularists would view as interesting. Does it have any public policy implications? No, it doesn't, and so it's not relevant. So if there's a belief that you think is weird, Joseph Smith looking at golden plates, certainly not high on my list of things I actually believe, does it have any public policy implications? And the answer is no.
Well, John Mark Reynolds, isn't part of the concern, though, on the weirdness objection that it's the way of thinking a person that would believe these kinds of things for the reasons that they believe them gives pause to certain voters?
That's an excellent question, which is why the second test needs to be that the religious group has been around for a long time and it has a significant number of followers, unlike the Comet cult, for example. Mm-hmm. And why is that so important? Well, we can look and see if they are trustworthy when they're put in positions of authority and power.
Mm-hmm.
And bluntly, I have to say to you guys that a religious group that produces Orrin Hatch and Donnie and Marie aren't causing me to tremble with fear for the Republic. And if anything...
You haven't heard Donnie's new CD, the Love Songs of the 70s, John Mark.
You know, if that's the worst that's going to happen to us, I think the Republic, which survived Jimmy Carter, the Southern Baptist,
mm-hmm.
will surely survive this. So I really think the weirdness argument needs to be dismissed for groups that have been around for a while.
What's your third point, John Mark, your third measuring point?
Is, in addition to numbers, that they need to have exercised control over some part of the Republic. And in the case of Mormonism, we have an excellent example of a group that is politically dominant because of numbers in the state of Utah for over 100 years, northern Arizona, Idaho, and some parts of Nevada. Harry Reid's a good example.
Mm-hmm.
They have played by Republican small r rules, and they have not proven to be totalitarians. People who are not Mormons are moving to Utah for the quality of life.
Mm-hmm.
You're not fleeing in terror from some kind of budding mm-hmm. theocracy.
Okay, those are all good points, and I'm signing on with this one. I just wanted to make the distinction for my listeners that some didn't hear, say, in the interview that you had with Dennis Prager, Hugh, and that was that, you know, we're not sitting here saying that all weirdness is the same and all bizarre beliefs are equal.
Yeah.
And maybe we'll have more to say about that later. But I am first one to admit that there are many Christians who have sound Christian beliefs but hold them for bizarre reasons. So we don't want to start disqualifying yeah. people for weirdness, because there are not only a lot of weirdness viewed from the outside, but a lot of weirdness, you know, just viewed from the inside as well.
Yeah, and this issue of just bringing up the LDS in any public forum among Christians, it brings a lot of interesting folks out of the woodwork. So we want to make sure we're clear on this, that we don't believe there's good reason to believe these basic Mormon stories.
Right.
We don't believe that there's good reason. And if you want to solve the weirdness argument, we're not all offering up the same, like the equivalent levels of weirdness. If you want to solve this problem, you do what Stand to Reason does. Mm-hmm. You think carefully. You bring evidence to bear, and you make your case. Mm-hmm.
But we're not going to disqualify this candidate, for example, because he's part of a religion that has beliefs that we disagree with. When,
that's
in fact,
right.
Many Christians, as I pointed out, hold their Orthodox beliefs for rather odd reasons as well. They can all defend it. John Mark, we'll let you jump in just a second after the break. Greg Kokel here with Hugh Hewitt, Craig Hayes, and John Mark Reynolds. We're talking about a Mormon in the White House, and I'm sorry, no, you can't call. I got these guys all to myself here on Stand to Reason. Stay with us. We've talked for a long time at STR about the importance of the tactical approach for an ambassador for Jesus Christ. Instead of finding yourself flat-footed and intimidated in conversations about your faith and values, you can increase your confidence and your skill in discussions, no matter who you're talking to, by using sound tactics in defending your faith. But now you can help others learn the material too by using the brand new, unique, interactive training tool, Tactics in Defending the Faith Interactive DVD for Small Groups. As a group leader, you can help your small group learn specific skills to initiate conversations effortlessly, stop challengers in their tracks and turn the tables, graciously and effectively expose faulty thinking, maneuver through minefields, present the truth clearly, cleverly, and persuasively. Included in the set are 6 one-hour interactive sessions on DVD with discussions, role-playing, self-assessment quizzes, recall exercises, memory tools, games, competition, all to help you learn more effectively. You'll also receive comprehensive leader and student manuals that are included in PDF form for printing and for copying for your group. You'll have everything you need to lead a group to be stronger and better equipped to skillfully present their faith. And it's plug and play. The DVD does all the work. That's Tactics in Defending the Faith Interactive DVD for Small Groups. It's $49.95 and includes 2 DVDs and 1 data CD. Order it at str.org. or call 1-800-2-REASON.
Does the Christian faith stand up to the scrutiny of critics? Tough scrutiny? How credible is the Bible, and how seriously should you take it? Can you entrust your eternity to its message? Based on Lee Strobel's provocative national TV program, the new DVD series, Faith Under Fire, features fascinating debates and riveting interviews with Christians, atheists, Muslims, and proponents of other faiths as they tackle today's hottest spiritual topics. Lee Strobel concludes each session by offering his own perspective. These 2 new DVDs, now available from Stand to Reason, include discussions on Is the Supernatural Real? Is Jesus a Prophet or the Son of God? Do All Roads Lead to God? Did Jesus Rise from the Dead? And more interesting topics. Guests include skeptic Michael Shermer, critics Edward Tabash, Richard Carrier, and Shabir Ali. Defenders of Christianity include Dr. J.P. Moreland, Dr. William Lade Craig, Greg Kokel, and Stephen Meyer. Contact Stand to Reason at str.org or 800-2-REASON to order these fascinating DVDs.
Woke up this morning feeling fine. There's something special.
Greg Kokel back with you here on Stand to Reason. And, this is – I'm locked in the 60s, guys, so I – or maybe this is early 70s. But my guest today and my luminous guests here, for my money, the best political talk show host in the country, Hugh Hewitt.
Thank you, Greg.
Who has written A Mormon in the White House, which is the subject of our conversation, and also 2 books that really had an influence on me, In But Not Of, which I recommend all the time to young people.
Thank you.
And Embarrassed Believer, which is one of your first on these kinds of topics, as
yep.
I recall. Dr. Craig Hazen, who's been a friend of Stand to Reason for a long, long time. He's the director of the MA program in Christian Apologetics. Also the editor of Phil Christie, which is not a band member from the 50s. It's actually short for Philosophia Christi, the journal of the Evangelical Philosophical Society, which, by the way, is the most successful and widely distributed journal of its kind
the
country. Congratulations.
Thanks.
And Dr. John Mark Reynolds on the phone, founder and director of the Torrey Honors Institute at Biola University. John Mark?
Yes.
You're still with us.
I am still here, and I would say your taste in music does mean that you're too weird. that's pretty much it for you.
You know, Melinda, we're talking about this whole question of how should Christians make their decision about this upcoming election, and since there is a Mormon on the ticket, and what appears to be a very, very qualified Mormon, all other things considered, his Mormonism may give some Christians pause. We're discussing that particular issue. And Melinda made an observation about the debate the other night at the Reagan Library, which you did color for, as I recall.
I broadcast from the Reagan Library on Thursday.
And apparently the evolution issue came up, and people had to be a show of hands about a very vague question. I have never seen the evolution question come up in any debate in the past. And the enforcer's observation was they've opened the door with Mitt Romney here and the religious issue. And so now a whole bunch of things that were not fair game in the past seem more like fair game now, even though they should be illicit as part of the conversation.
Isn't it a competition for the allegiance of the evangelicals?
Well, I don't know. I think it's a backdoor attack to begin an assault on Larry Arnn, president of Hillsdale College, says the American founding is steeped in two things, reason and revelation, and that we've always limited our conversation about reason in political circumstances, realizing that revelation opens us up to this knife fight. Because, you know, if we will never agree with Mormons. You know, we just aren't. And so if we're going to make common cause with them on marriage and on life issues, we just have to put aside that theological debate. So I think that the secular media is going to push religion, evolution, Mormonism, every day, all day, in an attempt. You guys know the Discovery Institute and the great Paul Johnson's phrase, which is to unify our side and divide their side. I think I'm paraphrasing it. One of you guys will remember it better. They're going to try and divide our side while unifying their
side. You know, I spoke at University of Missouri last week, and I had two lectures there. And after I gave this talk about bad arguments against religion, and I thought I made a pretty good case for our side, somebody got up and asked a couple questions that was meant to try to set me off pace. And I was responding to that. And he ended, well, then I guess – if God says all homosexuals are going to hell, then they're going to hell. Now, I think what – I didn't answer his question because it wasn't what we were talking about. But what his attempt was to do, since he couldn't have since get me on the grounds that we were discussing, he wanted me to say something bizarre so that it would color and poison the well for everybody else. My feeling is that this is what's beginning to happen here from the secular side. It's just what you were referring to a few moments ago. And that's why the evolution question came up. Let's find out who the bizarre people so we can disqualify them immediately from the discussion. John Mark, what do you think of that?
Well, if that's the attempt, then they're going to fail. Because I truly do not believe that traditional Christians are this stupid. And what they recognize is that an overwhelmingly secular media doesn't like them any more than they like Mormons. I have to say, and I've never said this out loud, and I'm about to blog about this week, if the California primary were held today, I'd be voting for Mitt Romney, because I think he's the only plausible candidate who right now shows the temperament and the policy that I agree with to be president of the United States. That's not an endorsement from Biola or Tory. That's just my opinion. And one reason for it is this is a man who knows how to properly think about the issues in a way that brings his faith to bear, but doesn't bring his faith to bear in a way that's scary or frightening. And in the areas where he brings his faith to bear, the public policy implications are exactly the ones I would personally want to see. And so if the attempt is made to demonize anybody who is a religious person, who part of their worldview, part of their decision-making process is that they believe in the supernatural, then I don't think people are so stupid that they aren't going to recognize that the next time somebody from the Assemblies of God runs for office, that trouble is looming.
Would you say then that Mitt Romney is, in a certain sense, this is highly qualified, but is a model for us on how we ought to do the same thing?
Well, that's exactly right. He refuses to get angry. He refuses to get dragged into the details of his theology, which would be grossly inappropriate for someone running for public office. Instead, he has really that kind of family-born Reagan optimism that bluntly we haven't seen for a while. I have to say, and I know this isn't about politics, but I'm sick to death of going into every debate since Reagan's era, dreading whether my candidate was going to stumble over words or say the wrong thing. Bluntly, I think we need somebody, if they're going to go up against Hillary Clinton or Obama or John Edwards, who is knowledgeable, who's smarter than the person he's arguing with, but also rhetorically skilled. And bluntly, I only saw one candidate who's viable on that stage who fit that bill.
One last question before we go to the other guys here, John Mark. Are you personally concerned about the way Christians are going to reason in this issue?
No, I'm not, because I really believe that there is a tiny, vocal, silly minority who you have to agree with them on everything or they can't work with you.
Mm-hmm.
But generations of us have worked with people we don't agree with on pro-life issues. We've worked on pro-family issues. We haven't been tempted to change our minds on theology as a result. I certainly haven't.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this kind of maturity is going to come to bear. Are you going to get email? Am I going to get email? Are there going to be wackos screaming one thing or another? Sure. Welcome to a free country. But there are millions of evangelicals, and the majority are too mature to get sucked into that.
Well, Hugh Hewitt, what is your concern about this? Because it seems like you wrote the book specifically to address this this kind of bigotry that you've identified in the culture.
Well, music to my ears. I think if you have Christian leaders like John Mark Reynolds and Craig Hazen at places like Biola University and conversations like this one on a leading radio program that speaks to evangelicals who are concerned with evangelical outreach and apologetics, then my work is done here. I just wanted to get
it's a good sign.
I wanted to get the smart people. And Chuck Colson was an early leader in this regards. And I believe that there is a decided turning and a recognition of what's going on from the left.
Mm-hmm.
And that there's a reason. Jacob Weisberg of Slate Magazine wrote the first anti-Mormon piece, the first anti-Romney piece, the second in the New Republic, the third by the religion editor of the Newsweek in the pages of the New York Times. There's a reason they are doing this. They see the seam, mm-hmm. and they're headed for the seam, and it's not going to work because enough serious theologians. I'm just a journalist. I can't do it. The theologians have to step into this gap, and they have done so, and I think they will do so in increasing numbers. And I think that's a leadership role that's been filled, and I'm very optimistic.
I think it's been interesting to watch Romney, and he obviously is being advised very well on this whole faith issue. He's taking advantage of actually something that we would consider a big problem in American religious thinking, and that is this separation of faith and knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
So that whenever his LDS affiliations come up, he parks it in the faith category, and Americans don't know what to do with that. So I think that's actually excellent political advice.
Expand on that. I think that's that. I got that, but that might be a little bit up here, I think, for people. You know, the faith knowledge.
Yeah, people like to think that religion resides in a particular category. And that's faith, something you can't really know or test or be particularly certain of.
Mm-hmm.
It swims around in sort of an amorphous pot, you know, and mm-hmm. you can't get a handle on it. If you throw your religion in there, you can't really attack it.
Mm-hmm.
And now we actually fight against that at Biola and Apologetics, and it stand to reason. We think that a faith is trusting that which you can know, and mm-hmm. so we're big on knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
The Mormon faith actually works very well in this regard, too, because it is, I'd say, one thing that really characterizes it in terms of its theology would be a strong separation between faith and knowledge.
When you say works really well, it's effective at keeping those apart.
That's
and
right.
And this helps keep Mormonism afloat in a certain sense.
That's right.
Yeah. But, of course, this is a separation, like you said, that we don't truck with. But at the same time, politically, it's a sound maneuver.
Well, sure, because Mormon apologetics have to go back to the golden tablets.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is where they're going to run into trouble since it's only 150 years. And mm-hmm. I've heard both of you and John Mark do apologetics, which is here's how reason raises up our revelation mm-hmm. to the point where it can be mm-hmm. compelling. Yeah. And I haven't heard Mormon apologetics. I just can't imagine it can work that way.
No, in fact, I'm sure there's many listeners. Greg's got a pretty good listenership of some bright people who engage Mormons on a regular basis.
Right.
And they know what happens when they start to push on these issues of evidence.
Yeah.
That the Mormon at some point takes a step back and says, now, wait a minute. You have to understand something. I've had an internal witness.
Right.
Of this,
mm-hmm.
and that's where it's going to rest for me. And so mm-hmm. at some point, evidence and knowledge stop being effective.
And they are forever protected then from any attacks if they can find safe harbor in that
that's
emotional
right.
experience, which is frustrating for a lot of Christian apologists.
But what I like about the fact is that you do have that engagement, and mm-hmm. you recognize that as citizens, they are 100% our equal. They are not mm-hmm. second-class citizens.
Yes.
We want to engage them. We want to talk with them. We want to have this colloquy about theology between mm-hmm. theologians.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to care if Mitt Romney is carrying around faith package with him, that he's bringing God to the public square, because I know he believes in a God who is not indifferent to the actions of men.
I think part of what you're saying, though, Craig and John Mark, I'll let you jump here in just a minute, is that because of this distinction between faith and reason, if Christians are concerned about the faith issues inappropriately bleeding into the policy issues, they have a system that keeps these things
absolutely
interestingly sealed from each other.
Yeah, it's a
right?
system that would actually work very well in American public life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. John Mark Reynolds?
Well, the good news is what this means is that Mitt Romney has a if he's a faithful Mormon, bad epistemology from a religious point of view for a traditional Christian, but an awesome one for a traditional Christian if they want to vote for a Mormon for the White House.
Mm-hmm. That's a good way of putting it.
We don't have to worry about what Mitt Romney is going to do based on his Mormon theology. You see, where Mormon theology does have public policy implications, it is actually in agreement with traditional Christianity. Mormons have tended in the last 100 years to be strong supporters of the family in an evolving way, and they've become strong supporters of a culture of life. So where we could expect any public policy implications, they're absolutely mainstream Republican.
So in other words, it's the values issues here, not the theological issues that matter.
Well, it really is. We're in a global war on terror, and we have a culture of life, as Pope Benedict would put it, that's under attack globally. We have burgeoning secularism of a negative sort, the kind that tries to reduce the humanity of humankind to zero. Against all of these things, Mitt Romney has stood at the center. He was governor of a state in which Harvard and other strong bastions for this kind of corrosive secularism began to attack the dignity of human beings. He's had to, if he can deal with Harvard, he can deal with Nancy Pelosi.
That's a good way of putting it. Hugh?
I have an anecdote that goes with this. I, in the course of writing A Mormon in the White House, I went to meet with his founding partner of Bain Capital, Bob White, called the first friend. Bob White is an investor and management guy who's made a billion just like Romney did, the old-fashioned way they earned it. And I asked him, and they've been associates since the late 70s. I said, now, Bob, how many times has Mitt Romney discussed his Mormon faith with you? Keep in mind, this guy has been with him hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours over tens of years. Never.
Mm-hmm.
Never. He is not, he does not bring into his workplace, which would, if he is successful, and we don't know that he's going to be the White House, he does not bring his faith paradigm into that, although he brings the character that his faith has forged into it, which is a character that's been married to one wife for 38 years, has five wonderful sons. And, I think that goes a long way. He also brings this up, to have these five boys, to anyone out there listening who have children, to turn out five who are all wonderful kids, wonderfully productive with great families themselves. He's invested along with Ann in those kids. I think that goes a lot further than the narrative of the Book of Mormon.
The irony is I was in D.C. about 4 weeks ago now, and I shared the stage with Cato Byrne, who is a Roman Catholic Roman Catholic, and she said the irony is that it's the Mormon of all of the people on the on the Republican ticket right now that has the best record with regards to marriage, that speaks really well for his values. The issue of bigotry has come up on your show a number of times, Hugh, and I wanted to talk about that a little bit. To me, it's a very loaded word that needs to be nuanced well. When you say that a lot of the opposition to Mitt Romney is just pure bigotry, you mean what?
If you look up bigotry in Webster's, it means an overwhelming distrust or even hatred for a particular group. Doesn't mean curiosity. Doesn't mean, hey, tell me about that. Doesn't mean anything like that. It just means a reflexive hostility towards a particular racial, gender, ethnicity, or religious background.
Kind of a prejudiced view.
Right.
As opposed to a principled kind of rejection of theology, sociology, or whatever it happens to
be. You're not bigoted if you say I say it all the time. I don't believe the Mormon story. Never have, never will. Can't imagine it being true. But that doesn't make me bigoted. That makes me a theological opposite. If in every conversation about Mitt Romney I bring up reflexively, I'm not going to vote for him because he's Mormon, then I would be a bigot, because a bigot allows to stand in their way a fully formed prejudice against someone. It's like, I won't vote for Obama because he's a black. I won't vote for Lieberman because he's a Jew. Those are easily recognized bigoted statements. The reason that the Mormon statements are not being not self-censored so much as shunted aside and condemned is that we don't have experience with them. We have come to recognize we ourselves are not bigoted on the basis of race. We've been taught by our families, our friends, and our culture to recognize bigotry when directed at a person of color, or when directed at Catholics, or when directed at evangelicals or Pentecostals, or Armenians. We recognize it. We hear it. We haven't learned to recognize it yet about Mormons. And if someone wants to say to me, the Armenians get a little crazy when it comes to the Turkish genocide, that's not a bigoted statement. If someone says to me, the Armenians should never be trusted on anything because they've just never been trustworthy, that's bigoted. I think we're developing an ear for Mormon bigotry, which is long overdue, but is coming up.
Well, also because there's a somewhat of an affinity between Mormonism and classical Christianity, and classical Christians are still open season on Christians and on our culture. So that may be another reason why people haven't responded so quickly about it. We got to go to break here. I want to talk about, when we come back, the issue of cult. Because this is also something that's tossed about, and I think that's a term that needs to be nuanced as well when we talk about it. My guest here, Hugh Hewitt, the book A Mormon in the White House, Dr. Craig Hazen from Biola, and Dr. John Mark Reynolds, also from Biola Tories Honors Institute. We'll be back with more conversation right after this. Stay with us.
Tired of defending your faith with "the Bible says so," "does too," or "I think it does"? Do you remove yourself from conversations with friends and coworkers about sensitive subjects like abortion and homosexuality? Stop being unprepared and call today for the latest issue of Solid Ground, the bi-monthly newsletter of Stand to Reason. This free publication is filled with practical information and useful tools to help you articulate your faith and have a biblically grounded understanding of subjects like same-sex marriage, evolution, stem cell research, and partial birth abortion. Don't be embarrassed or unprepared when you stand up as a Christian ambassador. Simply pick up the phone and call Stand to Reason today at 1-800-2-REASON. In each issue of Solid Ground, Greg Kogel teaches you how to represent your faith as an ambassador of Christ in a concise and attractive yet effective manner. Learn tactics tempered with wisdom that make your beliefs persuasive, not naive. So contact us today at 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON. Or visit us on the web at www.str.org. Ask for the latest copy of Solid Ground to be sent to you today. It's free when you call 1-800-2-REASON.
The dictionary defines the word expand this way: a verb, to open up, to unfold, to increase the extent, number, volume, or scope of. Stand to Reason's focus in 2007 is expanding horizons, a goal born out of our desire to increase your understanding of what it means to be Christ's ambassador, and to open up the riches of truth in new ways, and explore new ways to be more effective as an ambassador for Christ. No conference is better at doing that than our annual Master Series in Christian Thought. This year's lineup of speakers will challenge you to expand your horizons as you face the pressures of being a Christian in today's world. These extraordinary minds will broaden and deepen your understanding of truth amidst an antagonistic and divisive culture. Never has the need been greater for Christians who confidently and competently defend what they believe. You can order the lectures individually, or even better, you can benefit from the entire series. Dr. J.P. Moreland, Dr. James Emery White, Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse, and our own Greg Kokel and Alan Schliemann. Visit str.org or call 800-2-REASON to order this series that will expand your horizons.
Show us Stand to Reason, ladies and gentlemen. Greg Kokel, your host, with you every Sunday, 3 to 5. That must sound like a cakewalk to you, Hugh Hewitt, my guest here, who's 3 hours every day, 5 days a week, plus all the other things you do at Chapman Law School and your writing. And the topic of our conversation now, A Mormon in the White House, has moved to the top of the charts, retreated just a little bit, but it's still way up there. 10 things every American should know about Mitt Romney. Dr. Craig Hazen here with me from Biola, also Dr. John Mark Reynolds on the line. And John Mark, I don't think I could have taken it if all three of you were in the room at one time here. That would have been just too much for me.
We would have used up so much of the oxygen that the room would have imploded or exploded from all the hot air that at least I tend to expel at times.
Let's go to Hugh for a minute, and we're going to bounce this around between Hugh and Craig, and I want you to jump in whenever you want to, John Mark. This sure. question of a cult. I mean, the Mormonism, along with a whole host of other groups that you're actually an expert on, this is what you did your PhD work on, Craig Hazen, is identified in Christian material as a cult of Christianity. And most followers of Christ are aware of the distinctions there. You've really bristled at the term cult being used on the air to describe Mormons, Hugh Hewitt. And is there a disconnect here? Or are we working on different definitions?
Well, my definition of cult involves coercion. And in the modern background with Jim Jones's People Temple, Hale Bopp and others, and Hare Krishna, places where there is either mental or physical coercion that obliges a member to remain within. Mm-hmm. That is what American culture understands cult to be, and that therefore to use the term is to imply that the Mormons are doing that when in fact they don't do that. There is no coercion involved in recruiting into or maintaining within the Mormon church. And I'd ask my scholar friends here, it's not the way I think Jesus would approach someone. Mm-hmm. And did Christ use the term cult in the Gospels in describing anyone? Did he? Craig? John Mark?
No.
Greg?
Well, he didn't, but I don't know if that's the right question to ask, because he was actually quite quite abrasive regarding people who had the wrong views compared to orthodoxy, and he was very aggressive in dealing with that. So whether he did or he didn't, I don't know if it's the right question here, because we're dealing arguably with a little different situation. But we want to be as accurate and precise about these things with all the consideration of John Mark?
Let me suggest something here. It's become very difficult for my students to read a translation of Nietzsche that uses the term the gay science, which at one point was a perfectly acceptable way to translate a title of one of Nietzsche's books. But now I don't think talking about the gay science communicates quite what anybody had in mind at the time.
Right.
Sometimes terms are perfectly useful in academic circles. Mormonism is clearly a Christian-like religion. It's spun off from Christianity in some ways, similar to, in technical language, in my field of study, we talk about the Christian cultus, spinning off from Judaism,
right, in the first century.
And as a traditional Christian, if pushed and asked this question, are Mormons Christians, I would have to answer no, they're not in any sense traditional Christians. They're a spinoff group. Mm. The problem with the word cult is, as Hugh has just pointed out, it has ceased to mean something that we can talk about in technical discourse or in apologetics or in philosophy. And when it's used in public, it means nasty people that
yes.
live in movies like Deliverance that mm-hmm. want to kill you. and so I think it ceased to be useful in public discourse and makes the people who use it not carefully, not in context of classes and things where they've carefully defined it, sound themselves like the kinds of people you don't want to have as next-door neighbors.
Mm. Okay, so in other words, the word cult could be used not as a pejorative, but simply as a description, a theological description.
Well, it could be, but gay used to be able to be used in poems I wrote to my wife to mean that I was happy to be married to her, but if I tell my wife today that I'm gay and glad to see her, it's just not going to communicate.
Well, see, the problem is we actually have – it isn't – I mean – the word gay has been, I don't know if transmogrified is the right word here, but it's been totally changed, so it's taken on an entirely new meaning. It has really no hint of memory of the past meaning. However, the word cult does different works with different people, and I can understand in the area that you speak to, Hugh, on your program with your audience, very broad, conservative, but not theologically in tune particularly, mm-hmm. the word cult has this other connotations, and I can hear your resistance to it. Yet there are a lot of people who are Christians who are understanding it in a more theological sense, a sense that Dr. Hazen is more familiar with, that wonder if maybe there isn't enough clarification as the distinction between these words, and maybe the Mormons are being led off a little bit, like just another denomination of Christianity.
I just want to add, it goes to the motive of the person asking me to use it. If they want me to use it as a term of denunciation, as a condemning the Scarlet Sea, I won't. Mm-hmm. If they want me to avowedly state off, they're not Trinitarians. Their doctrine of God is completely different from ours. Mm-hmm. We don't believe the same things. There's no bridge. Mm-hmm. I mean, Craig might think there's more of a bridge than I do. I refer to it as a sect. Mm-hmm. But I find that the people who want me to use it as a cult want me to use the word as a bludgeon, mm-hmm. to strike them down and smote them. And really bad.
Okay. I'm totally with you on that. I think it's a pejorative that you attach to people you don't like, or you don't want to have to argue against them. You just want to attach a bad name. But the word cult actually has a lot of it's very helpful in certain disciplines, like the sociology of religion. If you go to a meeting of the of those guys, they would know what cult means in their discipline, but it's very carefully defined. It's not a pejorative. It helps them understand particular categories. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I find it completely unhelpful in Christian witness these days.
Mm-hmm.
Completely unhelpful. It simply just antagonizes the people you're trying to bring the gospel to. It's
right.
just
okay.
Not
in public discourse, though, how do we keep from a confusion of casting Mormonism just as as just another denomination of Christianity, which I suspect none of you would be comfortable in saying. So how do we make that distinction for all of the Christians that are listening in the conversation?
Well, not to advertise the Scriptorium blog, but I just finished a six-part series trying to deal with this very question. I'm a traditional Christian. I'm not a Mormon. I don't, if pressed, don't think that Mormons are Christians. Mm-hmm. And when I talk to my Mormon friends, and I do have Mormon friends, we have interesting and thorough philosophical and theological disagreements. Here's the problem. The most effective way to do that is not to use language that's overly technical or is understood only inside my community mm-hmm. or turns off the very people I'm trying to talk to. And I'm afraid that Mormons have experienced generations of religious persecution. We have to admit that that's true. It is true. And words like cult have been used as devil words to marginalize people and keep them from things that they do deserve in a free and open society. And mm-hmm. we have to be sensitive to that.
Mm-hmm. And I tell people, you know, the traditional Christian church, whether Catholic or Protestant, believes that there are three persons in one God, and the LDS faith does not, and that they believe that Scripture is closed at mm-hmm. the conclusion of the revelation, and that the LDS Church does not, mm-hmm. and that therefore they have nothing in common other than the New Testament and the Old Testament, which they read differently mm-hmm. than Christians do, and that therefore that chasm is vast, mm-hmm. but that they have a respect that we ought to be paying to them, a dignity that we ought to be respectful of, and it doesn't involve the pejorative use of terms that drive them away
from
the
conversation. I'm fully in agreement with that. This tradition of stand to reason, of course, is to be that way with everybody.
That's right.
And you guys know this because you've been around long enough.
Yeah.
So
I am
trying to, in a sense, speak for some of our constituency who are concerned about, in a sense, allowing Mormonism just to be viewed as another Christian denomination, which they'd be very happy to do, by the way. And so there's a resistance to that. But I understand you guys are working in different disciplines and speaking to a different audience with different purposes, and that's why you use different language.
But we're not disagreeing with those people. If you're in a profession or you're working with people and you're making a distinction between traditional Christianity and Mormonism, I'm on the traditional Christian team. Mm-hmm. We need to do that carefully.
Yeah.
There's no fudging. There's no hedging going on here. Here's the case. I have no idea, and I've read a lot of biographies of him, what Ronald Reagan's full-blown theology was.
Mm-hmm.
But if Ronald Reagan could run for president tomorrow, I would vote for him in a minute.
Mm-hmm.
He was an effective president, and as far as I can tell, no one has yet to figure out his theology.
Mm-hmm.
So I believe that people need to not hear what we're doing as some kind of compromise or fudging about mm-hmm. the gospel. What they need to hear is that we're making the important critical distinctions so that we don't fall into bigotry while attempting to be clear.
Mm-hmm. Well said. In fact, I deal with Mormons at a fairly high level on a fairly regular basis, and I don't go in talking about their movement as a cult. It would simply shut down the conversation, and I want to have a continuing dialogue to move them towards the gospel. But they're not offended by words like new religious movement. Now, that could be offensive. I wouldn't want somebody calling...
What about
calling,
sect? Yeah,
sect?
That was the word that you...
That's
prefers.
The word I usually use.
Sect, unfortunately, that has a... That carries with it the meaning that it's a kind of Christianity, and mm-hmm. I'm loath to admit that the Mormons are in any way Christian.
You know, Hugh just identified two distinctives between Mormonism and classical Christianity: the Trinity and their view of Scripture and Revelation. What are some of the others that might stand out for you, Craig? Because you work a lot with these folks.
Oh my goodness, there's quite a chasm. The mm-hmm. the divide is certainly wide. Mm-hmm. You know, to misquote
the afterlife
the title.
Is significantly. Mm-hmm. I mean, just.
And the
poor
life.
Yeah, I mean, here's the problem. Christians are monotheists. I'm not sure how many gods there are in Mormonism.
Oh, they're not monotheists, that's mm-hmm. for sure. And if you go read the Mormon scriptures as I do in the book, they're very blunt about that.
Mm-hmm. You know, if there's a modern religion that's unsure how many gods there might be, that's not very attractive to me.
Well, it's also not Christianity.
That's right.
You know, because there's no question about that. We just have a few minutes left, about five more minutes, and I want to talk a little bit about political strategy here and get I think we've covered a lot of important ground so far, but really what the question is now that you guys are interested, particularly Hugh, in your political contribution in talk radio, is how are we going to make this decision coming up that's such a vital decision? And how would you I guess I want to know two questions. One is, how would you counsel Christians to think about this issue in making the decision? And secondly, what are the strategic considerations for making a vote for the President of the United States?
On the first page of the book, I quote from David McCullough, a biography of Truman. At 9:20, the telephone rang in the hall. Dean Acheson was calling from his country home in Maryland. "Mr. President," he said, "I have very serious news. The North Koreans have invaded South Korea." And I write, "It is with evenings like that one in mind that Americans ought to cast their primary and general election votes for president."
Mm-hmm. Oh, well said.
That is, to me, why we pick a president, because bad things happen to good people with huge regularity. Who is the best equipped to deal with that? Mm-hmm. And I agree with John Mark. I wrote, if the election, the California primary, were tomorrow, I would vote for Mitt Romney. Doesn't mean I'm going to vote for Mitt Romney, because there's a long way to go. Right, he might cry in the back of a truck. He might take the microphone away from someone else and get caught doing so. He might declare Poland a free country. You know, who knows? But right now, and I had nothing to change my mind in the debate last Thursday, but we got lots of debates coming up. Yeah. I think Mitt Romney's the guy I want to get that call.
You served in the Reagan White House.
That's
you served in the Ford White House. You served in...
Nope, I'm not old enough. I worked with Richard Nixon in his retirement in San Clemente. But I campaigned for Jerry Ford.
You didn't work in the White House. You were involved in those administrations.
In the Ford campaign,
And you, with Dick Nixon.
Yep.
Richard Nixon.
Yep.
So you've got a lot of exposure to people in that highest office. What is your take on this man as a candidate for that office?
I worked very closely with Richard Nixon, but I like to tell people I shared an office for a year with a pretty smart lawyer by the name of John Roberts, who's now the Chief Justice of the United States. About the smartest guy I've ever met, and he did all the work, so we were happy to have John there. The Chief Justice was that smart. Mitt Romney has that kind of incandescent intelligence, and counts for a lot. It counts, you know, he just knows, gets into it, learns, studies, absorbs, and doesn't have to relearn. That's a great advantage in the presidency.
What's your counsel, Dr. Hazen?
It's so far to go. Let me give two unabashed plugs here. One for this book that Hugh has written. You need to go out and get it, not just to find out about Mitt Romney, but to find out about a broader conversation going on in America.
Yeah.
How should we think about these things? Mm-hmm. And this has brought a great spotlight to these issues. And another plug is for Stan Therese. And folks, if you're not supporting Stan Therese, and you need to, because look, Greg and company offer up programs like this and bring in some high-level people like Hugh Hewitt to discuss issues that we all need to learn about. Greg, you're a great teacher, and I'm so glad to be here.
Thanks. I'll give you $10 when we finish the show.
Coffee for you.
Yeah, that's right. Thank you so much. And John Mark, you're kind of a parting shot here. What's your counsel? We got another minute and a half or so. What's your counsel to Christians who are thinking about this decision? And really, are people of conscience? They want to be faithful to Christ in this. They're concerned about Mormon theology and Christianity, but they also want to have a good man in the White House that can reflect their values.
I just finished a 6-part series on Scriptorium, my blog, on this issue. You know, the Protestant martyr Cranmer, who died for his faith, wrote a prayer that in my church we pray every week. "We beseech thee also so to direct and dispose the hearts of all Christian rulers, that they may truly and impartially administer justice to the punishment of wickedness and vice." I'm looking for a president that will truly and impartially administer justice to the punishment of wickedness and vice. And we live in a world where there are wicked people ridden with vice who want to kill millions of Americans. We live in a world where unborn children have been declared subhuman. I'm looking for someone that will truly and impartially administer justice, and I think that the character of the candidate is the best reflection of whether they're going to do that. And it's apparent that Mitt Romney has that kind of character up to this point in the race. And so we have to begin to vote the way we pray, and that is vote for a candidate who can truly and impartially administer justice.
Mm. Well said, gentlemen. The enforcer just gave us 2 more minutes to talk here, so let me just jump to one other issue. A lot of people are thinking about the pro-life issue, and Mitt Romney used to not be, and now he is pro-life. And this troubles some people. This is called by some on the other side a flip-flop. Seems to me there's a difference between a flip and a flip-flop. How do you take this change?
I go back to my conversation with Archbishop Chaputte of Denver. He said, we need more people to do what Romney did, which was come over to our side. And he has a narrative that is compelling. How did it happen? Peter Flaherty, his general counsel, brought in Marianne Glendon, professor of law at Harvard, brought in Robbie George from Princeton, brought in every great pro-life thinker he could find. Mm. And he persuaded through this dint of this stream of pro-life intellects Romney to change his position to, you know what, we're wrong. Mm-hmm. We've got to stop. We've got to have Roe v. Wade overturned. That's a story I like.
Mm-hmm. Cato Byrne said that you know, this guy's been in so many interviews so far defending his view, and by the time the year is out, he will have been in 1,000 more. There is no possibility this guy, even if he wanted to, could change his view and maintain his political credibility. But isn't this what we want in politicians? We want him to learn a few things over the years, and if he's persuaded by a good argument, which is apparently what he got, certainly the arguments are available.
Even if we put not our trust in princes, here's what I look for. You look for the kind of people that the guy hangs around and the kind of core values he has. You know, we've been talking about Mormons all the time, but one thing we know about Mormons, they love families, they love family values, they're not into the culture of death, and they're not into secularism. So when I look at a candidate and say, can I trust what he's saying right now, I look and see if he's hanging around the kind of people that and has the kind of core values that would make him trustworthy, and it seems like he does.
Well put, and it's a great way to end the show. Hugh Hewitt, my thanks for you coming
on.
A very difficult schedule you got. I'm glad you showed up this evening. 6 minutes late, but I was glad to have you. Craig Hazen, good to have you here again, too. And John Mark Reynolds, sorry you're not in the studio, but thanks for joining in on the conversation. Well, that's all time we have for this show today, my friends. Go out and be good ambassadors for Christ and give him heaven. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Bye-bye.